Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Clint Rogers. Welcome to another installment of our Keeping It Simple series entitled Divergence is Bad. Okay. I'm joined by our hosts, Mike Green and Harley Bassman of Simplify, and Professor Peter Atwater. Peter is an adjunct professor of economics at William & Mary and president of Financial Insights, a consulting firm that advises institutional investors, Fortune 500 executives, and global policymakers on how social mood affects decision-making, the economy, and the markets. Peter has been featured in numerous publications and authored multiple books. His latest book, The Confidence Map, Charting a Path from Chaos to Clarity, provides a groundbreaking framework for making better decisions by understanding and mastering confidence. I'm confident this will be a great discussion. Just two quick housekeeping items before we start. You can ask questions of our panel through the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen, and we'll answer them as we can throughout the conversation. As always, everything we discuss today is for education and informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. With that, I'll turn it over to Mike.
Fantastic. I don't know if anyone else knows, but Clint is basically a better looking version of me. This is going to be confusing for everybody on the screen. Peter, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure. Harley, good to see you again. How are you feeling?
All's fine, baby.
All right. Well, Harley and I are both feeling a little under the weather. He's got allergies. I'm not sure what I've got, but we're going to try to power our way through here. Peter, your book, The Confidence Game, is kind of, you know, unlike most authors, you're kind of less well known for your first book or your most recent book, and better known for a piece that you wrote back in, I believe it was 2020, called The K-Shaped Economy. Very quickly, before we jump into polls and everything else in which we're going to discuss elements of confidence, and we'll circle back, because I love the idea that some of the stuff that's coming out, your idea of the confidence map, that eventually we're going to recover from this cycle that feels about as bad as I ever remember it feeling, despite the fact that everything is at all-time highs and everybody's feeling really good. And we'll talk about some of those components. What is the K-shaped economy? What does that actually mean to you?
Yeah, so when I started to talk about it, I was noticing as COVID started to hit that people who could work from home, their confidence started to recover almost immediately versus folks who were working, you know, hospital workers, supermarket workers, truckers, you know, people who did not have that opportunity. And from that, I expected that the high end of the economy, that those at the top, would start to recover more quickly. It was simply a reflection of the fact that they felt better. And between the stimulus, both monetary and fiscal policy, they were going to be fine. But I was also equally concerned about those at the bottom. And at that point, people were throwing around all sorts of letters of the alphabet. We had V, we had L, we had U, we had, you know, the swoosh. You know, what kind of a recovery was it going to be? And I was like, no, this is going to be a recovery that hits those at the top and those at the bottom very differently. And candidly, it's played out that way. And it exists today, I think, in spades. I would say those at the top feel almost invulnerable, while those at the bottom are beginning to feel defeated. And so you have a small group who have done extraordinarily well, who are surrounded now by a large population that's pretty miserable. Not, you know, the benefits of this recovery have yet to flow to them.
So I'm going to go out of order here for 1 second. I want to actually share one of the slides, because this is one that just jumped out at me, and it speaks to something you just said, which is, this is coming from the Milken Institute, which is a global get together of all those who can afford, I think, the $35,000 price of admission For a couple of days of attendance. And Michael Milken was speaking at a credit panel, obviously a more interesting credit panel than what I would be on, but talking about liquid public debt markets and private credit. And he made an interesting observation, which is that covenants might be more valuable than spread. And this is, I think, actually a really important observation because it highlights the structure of debt. There's two components. Can you hear me?
You're getting a little wiggly, like, a little wiggly.
I am a little wiggly. My internet connection just told me that it's unstable. Am I better now?
Yeah, you're better now.
All right, perfect. Okay, so debt has two components to it, right? Debt has a fixed return. It gives us a guaranteed return. But it takes on a different characteristic, which is debt actually has a change of control feature in it. And so what Michael's really saying there is make sure that you actually have reinforced your change of control feature, that you are able to take ownership of something if distress emerges. And then the second observation fits perfectly with what you just said. Dan Primack at Axios was saying, I spent yesterday among the masters of the universe at the annual Milken Global Conference in Los Angeles and walked away with one overriding thought. Most everyone was quite satisfied with the current state of affairs. I thought that was, to me, that was like one of the most amazing kind of summaries of where things sit. We simultaneously are saying, hey, let's make sure that if we are going to lend people money, we're in a position to take over what they can't pay us back. And the second was, yeah, things are going pretty good. Well, for me, how about for you? And when I ask that question on the other side of the equation, I get a very, very different answer, which is if I look at the median household, there's really kind of this amazing phenomenon, which is for the first time really in history, we're now looking at an environment in which after paying rent, gas, interest expense, et cetera, they have less money left over than they did almost a decade ago, right? In real terms, it's not even a close match. And so, I, despite being an ardent capitalist, despite being about as, close to the Milken side of the equation as I can be, without a few extra zeros in my bank account, the simple reality is that we're looking at a world that looks very much like a K-shaped economy. People are really struggling at the low end. And at the high end, they're basically trying to figure out, hey, how do I take over ownership of stuff, right? It really does feel very, very different. What's your reaction to those two observations, Peter?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In fact, I used Dan Primack's piece in something I wrote this week because I thought he captured the mood at Milken incredibly well. And it wasn't just that they feel good, great, but they see nothing that's going to get in their way of making more money. You know, they're discounting geopolitical risk. They're discounting the Fed. They were just, this is going to be great forever. And that sort of extrapolation always gets my attention. But I'm equally concerned by the chart that you've put up because, yeah, And you really saw the impact of this in 2022 when gas prices started to go up. And, you had Kyla Scanlon, talking about the vibe session. It's like, no, that vibe session is a function of people having a very difficult time, filling the tank at the gas station. And I think those at the top have become so disconnected from that reality that they don't appreciate how widespread the pain really is today.
I absolutely agree with that. I think that is spot on. And you gave me the perfect opportunity to introduce our poll questions today. Can we bring those up, Jimmy? Or maybe we can't. Let me stop sharing here.
Pull that screen down.
Yeah, there we go. I got to stop that. It was my fault, not Jim's. Okay, so our poll question. The first one is, will the Fed cut rates before the election? The election date is 11/5. The FOMC date is 2 days later, right? So this is one of these really critical questions that I think a lot of people are struggling with. Harley has been very straightforward on this and has highlighted the underlying dynamic that the Fed does not want to be directly in front of the election on the cut, nor for that matter, do they want to be on the backside of it. So Harley, everybody thinks they are going to cut ahead of the election, or at least 58% of the crowd does. What's your reaction to that?
If it's not June, it's not happening. That's real easy.
So, what's your thought, Peter?
Yeah, I agree with him that, you know, they really cannot be seen. You know, the Fed naturally, you know, is biased towards whoever the incumbent is. And in this case, I think they've got to be very careful.
So why do you say they're biased towards the incumbent? I haven't heard that expression before.
Yeah, so the Fed's position is sort of, you know, protecting the house.
Yep.
And so if the house is doing well, the incumbent's odds of re-election go up. And that is, you know, if you look at the data over time, you know, those that are reelected tend to ride a wave of positive sentiment because the economy is doing better than when they started. And so, you know, the Fed has to be very careful not to be seen aiding whoever the incumbent is.
Peter, if I could dig into that, this K economy, which I agree with, by the way, I mean, trying to go gently around the politics, Trump is not the problem, although he's certainly a bad guy. Trump's a symptom of what's happening over here in this divergence. And so I want to ask you is, when we're looking at the K, you've got the up and the down, what do you think is the driver? And it could be demographics, it could be age, it could be location, it could be income, it could be wealth. So you have no income, but you have wealth. I mean, where is it? It could be the job type you have. In your view, what is the divider of this K? Well, what's the critical point?
So I think a lot of it has to do with occupation, that we've moved to a service industry that is highly mobile, that has access to technology, that has privilege in terms of wealth, safety, you know, basic health care. And so those jobs that serve others, you know, I joke that we live in this modern Downton Abbey environment where those at the top are incredibly beholden to this universe of people that they don't see, from the UPS folks to the, you know, the folks that are delivering everything to their homes. And to me, it's strictly a function of which end of that delivery chain are you on. If you are creating something to be delivered, and I don't care if that's food, goods, chances are you are at the bottom much more than you are at the top. The other element of this, though, is we have a clear ownership class and a clear employee class. And I joke that, you know, we are increasingly living in this Truman Show world where everything is owned by private equity. And I worry that if those at the bottom realized how beholden they are in you know, where they live, what they drive, you know, the privatization of so much of the American economy puts them at a real disadvantage.
Do you think tax policy from the Reagan era is what drove all this?
You know, I'm not a big believer in trickle down, just because when you start trickle down, it takes an awful lot of time for those at the top to feel generous enough to pass it along. So generosity and willingness to invest is slow if you start at the top. Now, having said that, I think we have to be really careful about what we're doing in terms of social policy, and particularly at a federal versus state level. So I don't want to throw one party or another under a bus, but I want to come back to something you said a moment ago. I think that the biggest divide in America is not left or right. I think it's up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that whether you like him or despise him, Donald Trump has tapped into the hostility of those at the bottom. And one of the things we forget is that follow, not fight or flight, is our easiest response. And so it shouldn't surprise anybody that this is also an era where we have authoritarian figures, both in the US and elsewhere, where people feel similarly crummy, who are coming to the fore.
And do you think this is because of the people who are at the top of what they're doing, or is it people at the bottom of the way they act? I'm not familiar with your work, but I mean, are you kind of like Richard Thaler or Daniel Kahneman in terms of how you approach behavior, or is it something else you focus on?
No, I'm much more consistent with them.
So like if you look at people, they tend to have this, people are scared of being hit by lightning. They're scared of being bitten by a shark, which is never going to happen. But they'll get the taxi and not put a seatbelt on, which is totally ridiculous. I mean, that kind of the way we're wired, the way we act, is that the problem? Or is it something different than that?
No, it's the way we're wired. And my focus is confidence. And to me, to be confident, the work that I've done says you need a feeling of certainty and control. COVID upended that. Those at the top regained both of those fairly quickly. But if you're at the bottom, your world has been uncertain and you have felt powerless for quite some time.
Would that mean that we're going to be, this next generation is going to be better because the snowflakes are all very confident because they're all given participation trophies? I mean, they should feel great.
If anything, Harley, it's the opposite direction, yeah. Right? The participation trophy has made them lack confidence because they know they didn't deserve it.
Maybe they don't, and they might.
And more than that, they haven't experienced real vulnerability.
No.
Those at the bottom, you know, vulnerability is called Tuesday. They know what it's like to be without certainty, without control. And so they're much better equipped for environments like this than those who have been, pandered to over their lives.
So you're kind of saying that is the problem that our politics has done various things to inhibit or discourage people, or is it when they're brought up by their parents or whoever the social group is, they haven't properly, you know, geared people to go and face the real world?
No, I think a lot of it is just, you know, for those at the bottom, it's just relative opportunity. You know, that they have been left behind in recovery after recovery after recovery.
I mean, you know where I'm going with this is I'm going to ask you now, like, okay, what do we do? Like, you're doing something now where you're what would we do?
So, I mean, this is where models around the world become interesting, troubling, relevant, whatever the word is. You know, you don't sustain this kind of divided economy comfortably. You know, when those at the bottom realize they can't gain, you know, they can't leap over this divide, you know, this is the environment of revolution. And so we, you know, those at the top should be, you know, very attuned to the fact that they are woefully outnumbered and that, you know, if things aren't given, they are ultimately taken. Having said that, if you look around the world, there are so many countries where this is normal, where there is a clear divide, a clear economic caste system between the haves and have-nots. But what it's accompanied by in almost all cases is extraordinary authoritarian leadership, that you have to have an oppressive leadership environment to sustain that. And so the question is, you know, where do we go from here? And I don't pretend to know. I just know that we are reaching a point where, you know, the arm and the leg of the K have become so spread apart that they're that's unsustainable.
Aren't you saying that people want that then? They want an authoritarian, they want to follow? I mean, you're kind of saying it's inevitable with what we have right now to have a more authoritarian type of politics.
I think if those at the bottom felt that an authoritarian figure would assist them, would help them, help their cause, they will get in line. History suggests that's what happens.
Okay.
So I think actually it's a good time to bring in another quick picture here. Let me actually share my screen one more time here. This goes to Harley's question about, you know, what actually changed? What was different? Hopefully this screen comes through, right? You guys should be seeing a slide that says trickle-up economics.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
So this is actually looking at the quantity of checkable deposits by income strata. This is your up-down dynamic that Peter is talking about. And we only have data back to 1989. This is coming from the Fed's Survey of Consumer Finances. But it is actually remarkable because there is such a tangible shift that occurred following the global financial crisis, where the quantity of checkable deposits, the quantity of cash on hand began to explode for those in the top 10%, really driven by an explosion by those in the top 0.1% and the top 1%, far more so than the, you know, remaining 9% per se. We'd gone from a very stable environment to one in which the resources for safety and protection, everything that Peter was highlighting, changed pretty radically. And that really is, like, we're all familiar with the Charles Murray dynamics of bad choices, right? Well, we also know that one of the reasons you make bad choices is because you're under-resourced, right? If you have to choose, do I buy X versus Y? Do I buy the car today or can I wait? If you have the flexibility of a second car in your house, you don't need to worry about overpaying for the car repairs. You don't need to worry about overpaying for the car. You simply do a slightly less for a little bit. That's simply not an option for an increasing fraction of our population. And I think it's one of these things that, candidly, you know, I've made a point on this on Twitter. I came up through the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business in 1988. When I entered the school, we were talking about the dynamics of shareholder value, right? Or stakeholder value, I'm sorry. The idea that there were entities other than the shareholders that needed to be the investors that needed to be taken care of. By the time I left in the early 1990s and went into the workforce, the dynamics of Milton Friedman's shareholder value management had become absolutely preeminent. Nobody stopped to think about, well, what about the responsibility to the community that you're part of, et cetera? It really radically changed just in that time period. And it's been fascinating to actually watch the dynamics of that in a Keynesian framework, right? We're all slaves to some defunct economist. I would suggest we are all firmly slaves to the Milton Friedman view of the world right now, particularly in the United States. And it's fascinating to watch those who are in many situations better served in alternate ways, touting the public line of, you know, extreme, basically anarcho-capitalism, right? Private entities should be able to do whatever they want. Peter, what's your reaction to that dynamic of the slave of a defunct economist and Milton Friedman has won?
Yeah, I mean, if we go back to, you know, the Revlon case, you know, which to me was the watershed moment that said, you know, boards must make the decision that puts the shareholder at the top. And we have taken that now to an extraordinary level. You know, the other thing I'd say, Mike, with the chart you just put up, don't forget the impact that rising rates then has on what happens to the money in those accounts and yep. to whom. That to me, we have this fascinating, are you a creditor or are you a lender or a borrower? Because to the extent that you are, you know, providing deposits today, you know, you are being handsomely rewarded. And then I look at the extraordinary cost of credit card debt, and you're paying a substantial cost to borrow.
Peter, and I don't want to make it a political question per se, but it sounds like you would think it would be the policies of like college debt forgiveness or guaranteed income. Those might be policies that would be helpful in flattening out this divide or not.
I think that we have to be careful anytime we're talking about programs like that, because we have to be much more, you know, Washington tends to paint with a very broad brush. And I think to the extent that you're going to look at debt forgiveness programs, they need to be better aligned with where you have issues of need, where you have issues of, you know, of you know, achievement. I worry that we've reached a point now where we've got, you know, really competent students who are forgoing medical school because they can't imagine ever getting out of that debt situation. And for a population that's aging, I don't think we're doing a very good job of paying attention to that. So I think we've got to be very tactical about what's the goal we're trying to achieve, rather than here's money for everyone.
So I would just add one more quick component to that, right? Which is, Harley, remember when you and I were in school and when you and I went to school, one, it was largely self-funded by families, et cetera. The dynamics of guaranteed student loans didn't exist, nor did the idea of non-dischargeability, right? And so what we've actually done is we've taken a huge step backwards. And I just want to be very clear. I'm actually not a fan of debt forgiveness in the way that we're handling it, to Peter's point. But the underlying dynamic that you're going to allow a 17-year-old to enter into a non-dischargeable debt contract to obtain an education that they have no price signals for, right? If you, you know, 50 years ago, if you had decided to go to MIT, you could find any number of people who would be willing to lend that money to you. But if you tried to go study underwater basket weaving at Santa Cruz, the odds were very slim that you would come up with the funds from somebody deciding that this was a good investment. So we robbed the system of those signals and at the same time handed unbelievable amounts of debt to students, where the vast majority of it now is actually going to students who didn't graduate. The remaining debt that's out there is going to students who didn't graduate and used it increasingly for lifestyle expenses, right? Things like room and board. So it is a venal system that we've created. And while I'm not a fan of the forgiveness, I very much am sympathetic to the underlying arguments behind it. This was a system that was set up to benefit the private for-profit educational system. It was not set up for the benefit of the students.
Yep. Well,
so I think we all need to kind of remember that as we start complaining about the dynamics. Now, do I think that we're fixing it by walking away from that debt and forgiving it? Of course not. I think this is possibly the least efficient way that we could ultimately do this. But we have actually created a system that is really, really, I think the technical term is messed up, to say the least. Peter, you wanted to add anything to that?
No, I think your point about bankruptcy is a really good one. You know, these young people have little choice but to borrow and no real appreciation for the consequences.
Appreciation. I want to add one more quick thing too, which is the younger generation, which is being forced, as Peter said, into credit card debt and student loan debt, right? The only two types of debt that are non-dischargeable in our society are credit card debt and student loan debt. We effectively have taken a giant step backwards from the dynamics of the 19th century recognition that debt contract forgiveness, the concept of limited liability and personal bankruptcy, was a critical component in terms of liberating and freeing up resources for the economy. So this is a fascinating environment in which, you know, Peter talks about the authoritarian dynamic. I hear a lot of people talk about debt jubilees, right? Debt jubilees are so fundamentally misunderstood. We actually had a variant of a debt jubilee in Saudi Arabia back when MBS emerged as the new leader, right? It was called, you, as a rich person, own lots of resources in the form of claims on our society. You're now going to give those to me because I'm the only person that matters, right? That's really what happens when a king takes over and declares a debt jubilee. He's actually bankrupting his opponents. So do I think we're coming to that? I don't think there's any question. It certainly seems that that's the direction that we're going. And I hope I'm wrong. I really, really hope I'm wrong. But I agree with Peter that the direction is leaning heavily towards following somebody who says, hey, I can get it done, regardless of whether they can or not.
I would argue that, you know, a decade ago that we kind of dismissed anyone who did not have a college education. And we still talk about politics of educated, not college educated, how they vote. I would say that if we, you know, took away that concept and said, by the way, you can skip college and become a welder, electrician, or a plumber, and you probably make $120,000 a year. That's not a bad idea at all. But we kind of made it, if you don't have a college degree, you're a loser. So we kind of sold the problem to ourselves.
Again, completely agree with you, and would suggest that a primary driver of that was the various public school, public education institutions and the unions associated with them. All right. What could be better for job security for public teacher unions than everybody has to go to college?
So, Peter, circling back, are there any specific ideas or directions you'd want to point us into?
In what respect, Harley?
Well, I mean, identify certain problems, which I agree with. Some of them I don't. I personally think, you know, how you're raising your family is the most important driver of everything. I think my kids were basically pretty much baked before they started reading the Times, the Journal. But is there policies that we should be doing or things we should be altering? I mean, identifying the problem is good, like that. But well, now, what do we do?
I think questions of national service should come up. You know, it doesn't have to be the military, but we, you know, instead of, you know, layering on, you know, debt burden after debt burden, you know, do you give people an opportunity like the ROTC students I have to, you know, get an education and repay it in the form of service of some sort or another? I think there are many more opportunities that exist that create greater equity across the system.
I love that idea. It'll never happen, but I mean, if we were to go create a two-year public service, you can do anything. You can go to the military, you can go and weave baskets or give out food, whatever it might be. I think it'd be a good way to go and have people become interconnected with society, but also make them a couple years older before they get to college, which they could probably use. And also, you know, you tend to develop relationships across the ecosystem when you go. I mean, I'm not sure I can say Israel anymore in public, but I mean, that's what they do there.
And I cannot agree with you more, Harley, on this need for personal connection. All of the smartphone technology has enabled people to create connections that are afar, but they've created this huge gap in real connections in their local community that are multi-generational, you know, across, you know, all measures of demographics, you know, wealth, race, religion. You know, we've forgotten that we used to know each other.
You know, I mean, all modesty aside, I'm more towards the top end of the food chain here, and which makes things challenging. Well, not for me, but for in general. What kind of things should we, people who have money, should we be doing? I suspect it's not BDS or ESG. Is there, what things should we be doing either as investors or as, you know, doing something towards what you're describing?
Well, I think there are, you know, some really interesting things that people can do in terms of, you know, whether it's, you know, we're talking about education. I mean, I look at the power of scholarship, you know, particularly, you know, merit and a combination of need and merit, where you are transforming somebody's life and setting them up on a path to be more successful than had they graduated with this burden of debt. But I think that in terms of investing more broadly today, I think we have to be thinking about things on a much more localized basis, where I think that we've spent so much time and energy focused on the next $10 billion, $100 billion, trillion-dollar business. You know, that everybody wants to have the next Facebook. And it's created a real void in terms of local investing. And I think that if we're going to change mood in this country, it comes from the bottom up, not from the top down. And so,
Peter, I absolutely love that comment for two reasons. One, I speak fairly frequently with large institutions, particular educational endowments, et cetera. One of the things I find fascinating is how little thought there is to this concept of investing locally, right? Shouldn't the UC regions and the UC system be investing to make California a better place as compared to maximizing the fiduciary responsibility to the returns of their pensions, et cetera? It's actually fascinating because this, I give the speech all the time as part of my greatest story ever sold on passive investing. Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. We've focused our system around the idea of maximizing financial returns with almost no consideration for maximizing human capital concerns or community dynamics associated with it. It's really an interesting challenge. And I don't know the solution to it either, other than changing the regulatory environment, right? Because and it's going to go in a cycle, because you know somewhere out there there's a CIO of the next, you know, UC Regents with or CalSTRS with hundreds of billions of dollars to invest, who is going to decide that his friend in the local community who runs a local charity is the best way to spend money, right? So there's going to be a cycle of corruption that goes in that direction as well. But nothing is perfect, unfortunately, right? We've just removed ourselves so far from the local. And I think this is true in the news cycle. I think, you know, everybody spends all their time discussing who the president is. Who's the head of your local school board? I'd be willing to bet 95% of Americans have no idea.
Not true. Peter, so maybe the idea is to, like, I mean, an Ares Capital that targets middle market, is that a better way of investing? I mean, if you want to do social good, although they do charge pretty high rates to people, than some other math method? I mean, you want to funnel money towards people who aren't eligible for bank loans or government loans?
No, I want to go even smaller than that, Harley. I think there is real power in local community development. And I can see it. You know, I live not far from Wilmington, Delaware, and I see some really exciting things that are being done that are being financed locally, that are being led locally, that are designed and focused on, you know, at the bottom of the hierarchy of need and working their way up. So, you know, if I can, you know, improve your breakfast, then I can improve your ability to learn in the classroom, which means then I can start to train you for jobs in other ways as you advance. And so I think we need to rethink about, you know, the true benefits societally, economically. You know, I think this isn't philanthropy. This is, you know, preserving a system and inviting more to join into a system that rewards hard work and creativity and ideas and service to others.
So what were you most surprised about when you transitioned from, you know, a bulge bracket Wall Street origination desk, which is a rather insulated business, to being at a large university? What did you learn or find that was new to you that you didn't expect?
I mean, I feel very fortunate. I come away, I mean, I gave my last exam yesterday. I could not be more excited about the future of this country when I see the students that I have the benefit to be with, who are at a public university in the state of Virginia, who are serious and interested and curious, and they are resilient, and their level of perseverance, you know, they are determined to create, you know, whether it's businesses on the entrepreneurial side or research that they hope to change. You know, we've got a lot of students focused on improving the waterways of the Chesapeake. You know, this is, it hurts my heart right now that all of the media attention on universities is focused on, you know, 10 or 15 universities. There are 4,000 universities in the United States. And on 99% of them today, there are young people who are trying to make a better life for themselves. And I feel like that's getting lost in the conversation today.
But you also think that this cohort, this generation, is less confident than our generation?
I think they're more anxious, but I actually think that that anxiety is being put to use well. You know, they're not bothered by change. They're not bothered by things that trouble our generation. They're excited by technology. They're not intimidated by it. And so I think, yeah, they have their warts. We have our warts as a generation. But I really bristle when people try to dismiss this generation as a group of snowflakes. Yeah, there are some snowflakes in there, but I see many more who are excited about where they are and what they want to do.
So I am somewhere in between the two of you and would just highlight that a lot of the complaints that our generation has about people in the labor force are not actually targeted those who are currently in school. This is a new generation, right? This is the Gen Z and even beyond that, as compared to the millennial generation. Harley, I'm sure you caught the news that an analyst at Bank of America died from overwork in the past week, right? You know, remember, this is a decade removed from the new kinder, gentler Goldman Sachs, in which parents were calling and saying, my son is working too hard and blah, 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 right? We've gone full cycle back to these are the best jobs available. You're going to work your ass off and you're not going to make any complaints, even if it requires you to basically drop dead at the desk. Right.
I would hope that wouldn't happen.
It just did.
I don't know anything about it. So
yeah, we are in a different place. This is a different group. This group is hardworking and sober. The question was actually asked, and Peter, I'd love your thoughts on this, which is, you know, I made the assertion that Milton Friedman won and that basically his story is one that everybody accepts and talks about. And Mark brought up the point, how do you reconcile that with the dynamics of DEI in the workplace? My personal take is that DEI is a fantastic distraction that was actually designed to and has been very effective in distracting anyone from the real activities that are ultimately going on. DEI is basically a large company solution to how do we make life really difficult for small companies because they can't address these things. We'll toss up various barriers to entry. They have to have legal compliance that they otherwise might not have to have, et cetera. To me, it's just a giant distraction more than anything else. Peter, I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like whether it was DEI or ESG, there was a lot of great intention, but we've consulted them. You know, they got too. They became so appealing that we had to make them bureaucratic and to take them to an extreme. And to me, some of that's the timing of it. You know, where they've come in this cycle. And there's such abstraction in both of them that it's difficult to get any agreement in terms of what they really mean. These are AI applied to yet another segment, not in terms of the artificial intelligence, but in terms of ambiguity and abstraction.
Yeah, the hallucinations are strong with that one. I that's exactly the point that I meant, which is if this was actually a real movement, if this was something that somebody wanted to change, then there would be tangible metrics that we could guide towards. The entire thing was basically set up to make it impossible for people to respond to.
Well, in all of these, you know, if there's going to be a real movement, it's going to start at the bottom and, you know, you'll have grassroots moving up.
Yeah.
Not from all of these to me feel very top down rather than bottom up.
Yeah, no, I think you and I see it very, very similarly in that framework. Let me jump to another slide here that I wanted to share. So one of the things that jumps out at me is that the, you know, immediate observation that people would make. I just realized I screwed it up. Give me one second here. Okay. I think that's the one I want. Okay. Hopefully no one's looking at Mark Jacobs' thing. All right. You guys are looking at a screen that says the bottom 50% had more cash than before. This is the pushback that we often get, right? Particularly around the dynamics of the K-shaped economy. Well, everybody is doing better. The bottom 50% now have significantly more cash, or at least as of 2022, the last data that we really have, had significantly more cash on a per capita basis than they did going in, right? Combination of stimulus, lower spending dynamics, et cetera. But to me, there's two things that are really important that's going on here. One is these strata are always set up by income. And so part of what's actually happening is that the bottom 50% is becoming more and more represented by retirees. Right. If you move on to Social Security or you only have a certain quantity of capital in your 401k, the odds are very high that you are now in the bottom 50 percentile on the basis of income. But ironically, that also means that the bottom 50 percentile now is asset rich relative to what it has been historically. So we'd seen these dynamics rising, falling and then rising in a pattern that matches the demographics. The supercharge associated with COVID, I don't think there's any question that that definitely improved things. But again, I would direct people to think about what really happened. We gave a lot of money to old people. We just gave a lot of money to old people. The second thing is remember that this bottom cohort spends everything. And inflation only affects your spending. It doesn't affect, you know, this is where Harley and I argue all the time on the dynamics of inflation. One of the reasons why inflation hits the poor so hard is because they have so little savings margin. And so every dollar that comes in basically gets increased by that change in the price level. And so if we actually adjust for that change, congratulations, we're all the way up to, you've now got a full month of spending, right? You know, like this is actually really astonishing when you think about the dynamics of the advice that we offer to people. It's really easy to make bad choices if you don't really have a choice, right? If you don't have the backup, et cetera. Peter, what's your reaction there?
Yeah, I love the discussion. You know, I'm a big fan of the book Scarcity. You know, why not having enough matters, you know, yep, more than we think. And I think that your point about inflation is right. It introduces uncertainty and powerlessness like nothing else. And so the idea that you're making decisions that are based on a month's worth of cash or less, you are focused on me here now, like there's no tomorrow. And I don't think, again, we appreciate the consequences of that. You know, when I ask people, you know, the quickest way I know to evaluate your level of confidence is to have you tell me, what are you planning? You know, what are you planning? A trip, but, you know, just how far out does your calendar go? And what we find is that those at the bottom can't plan.
Yeah.
It's not a choice. And so imagine your life unable to plan for anything.
And there is, I mean, to be fair to those who argue that to the Charles Murrays, et cetera, of the world, right? There is an element of personal responsibility associated with that. There are choices, particularly in our society, that can be made. But I really do think that this is one of the things, the question was asked, Harley, what can you do as an individual? I really do strongly encourage our listeners who come from a much more affluent group to pause for a second and put yourself in the shoes of somebody who doesn't have the resources that you have, right? And whether that means volunteering in your local community to actually meet some of those people. I mean, this to me is one of the real tragedies of the breakdown of many of our systems of institutions. You know, we've lost the integrative nature of all going to church on Sunday and seeing our neighbor and asking honestly, how are you, right? Instead, we're much more interested, myself included, in fighting with people over Twitter or over podcasts or putting in our headphones and listening to what we want to listen to as compared to what's happening in the world that's around us. So I think that to me is one of the really critical things. We're starting to run short on time. The other thing that I would just emphasize in exactly that framework is it's remarkable to me how much the political discourse has shifted. I've raised this point on Twitter. I know you've seen it, Peter. In 1992, Bill Clinton ran under the mantra, it's the economy, stupid, right? People couldn't understand. How could people be so upset at George Bush? How could they be so how could they be so unhappy in an environment that looked so tangibly better than the world that existed a decade before, right? We forget that, you know, 1992 is the anniversary of the 15% inflation and the start of the bull market from a 4x PE and 11% unemployment in the United States, et cetera. 1992 looked like a walk in the park. Highlighting for people as the economy stupid was a very straightforward way of saying, this is why you're upset. Those same entities today, this is Kyla Scanlon with the Vibe Session, for example, right? You're all dumb. This is just because you don't feel this way, right? It's not actually happening to you. And I just want to actually highlight one last chart to wrap this up, because I think this is, to me, this is alongside the money left over. This is kind of one of these money shot type dynamics, which is highlighting that if we look at unemployment, something really important is actually happening, which is that getting a college degree no longer insulates you from unemployment. And this is a really critical change. And it's one that I try to emphasize to people and help them understand. But the historical unemployment rate for those with a college degree is around 1%. Right. So when we talk about 4 or 5% unemployment rates in the economy, we're completely ignoring the fact that those who have traditionally become more skilled educationally run with dramatically lower levels of unemployment and greater levels of surplus, right, in terms of their income. That's meaningfully starting to change. This cycle, we're actually seeing the college graduates in oversupply. Right. We spoke earlier about a couple of other examples. Have you read the work of Peter Turchin and the surplus of the elites hypothesis? What's your reaction to this underlying dynamic, Peter, where we're seeing those with college degrees lose first here for the first time?
Yeah, I think we have to appreciate that the percentage of Americans who are part of the higher education system, who are now graduates, is, you know, at a highest level. And so it shouldn't surprise anybody that there is now a relative equality in terms of unemployment. The other thing I would highlight too, and this I think goes back to Harley's point, if you look at the scarcity of workers for a lot of, you know, non-college jobs, you know, they continue to be deficits. You know, if you want to be an HVAC person, if you want to be a plumber, if you know, so it shouldn't surprise us either that the unemployment rates are comparable. In fact, I can see a situation where the unemployment rate for college graduates begins to exceed non-college graduates, just given the scarcity of workers that exists today in a lot of those jobs.
And again, when we engage in something, you know, just very quickly, like to Peter's point, right? The unemployment rate for fine arts majors is 7.9% currently. For those who are English language majors, it's 6.6%. If I were to make a guess, I'm going to hypothesize that it's significantly lower amongst some of the technical degree areas, although the layoffs that are coming from the Googles, et cetera, of the world are meaningfully impacting those careers, as we saw in the recession in 1990s, which was really one of the first technology dynamics.
I can tell you, Mike, if you were to poll my students, there is a clear vocational focus in their degree, given their levels of debt that they're taking on, you know, the cost of education and their general awareness of the need to have a job when they graduate. These kids are not messing around. And I worry that, you know, 2 years from now, we're going to be talking about a glut of engineers and computer science, because so many students have chosen to go into those degree programs.
I think that's absolutely spot on. And I've made this point publicly as well. So I have three children, two of whom are basically getting vocational degrees. One's getting it at the University of Pennsylvania, like I did. And the second is doing it at the U.S. Naval Academy. And, you know, in both situations, their level of stress relative to their older brother, who pursued a liberal arts degree, when he graduated, his stress level and amongst his friends was off the charts. For them, it's more a question of, man, how can I find some vacation time before I get launched right into my career? It's a very different experience. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that this younger generation is actually waking up to some of these underlying dynamics. It sounds, Peter, like you're very much seeing that. I agree, there's something lost, but let's really be actually quite honest about it. Fine arts degrees should be the province of the exceptionally wealthy and the unbelievably gifted and talented in that field, because it's a terrible degree. I'm sorry. It doesn't prepare you for anything other than how to spend rich people's money. And you know, there's value in that, but boy, it helps if you start out knowing a lot of rich people to get those jobs. So with that said, I think we've rounded off on all the points that I wanted to hit on. Clint, you want to bring us home?
Hey, thanks. They're going to invite me back. You guys are finishing on time today.
It was all you, man.
Well, thanks, Peter, Mike, and Harley, for some great information and conversation. Thanks to everyone who was able to join us today. Please consider registering for our next Keep It Simple on June 13th, featuring Anupam Ghosh from System 2 Advisors, to discuss the compelling economic dynamics and investment opportunities in India. I hope you'll join us then. Have a great afternoon and evening, and thanks again.
Thank you very much, everyone. Remember San Dimas High School football rules. Take care.
Simplify Asset Management, Inc. is a registered investment advisor. Advisory services are only offered to clients or prospective clients where Simplify Asset Management, Inc. and its representatives are properly licensed or exempt from licensure. SEC registration does not constitute an endorsement of the firm by the commission, nor does it indicate that the advisor has attained a particular level of skill or ability. Be sure to first consult with a qualified financial advisor and or tax professional before implementing any strategy. This website and information are not intended to provide investment, tax, or legal advice. This content is solely for informational purposes and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies. These materials are made available on an as-is basis without representation or warranty. The information contained in these materials has been obtained from sources that Simplify Asset Management, Inc. believes to be reliable, but accuracy and completeness are not guaranteed. This information is only current as of the date indicated and may be superseded by subsequent market events or for other reasons. Neither the author nor Simplify Asset Management, Inc. undertakes to advise you of any changes in the views expressed herein. Past performance is no guarantee of future returns. Investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Unless otherwise noted, any performance returns presented in these materials reflect hypothetical performance. Hypothetical strategies and indices presented are unmanaged, do not reflect any fees, expenses, transaction costs, commissions, or taxes, and one cannot invest directly in any of these. The results presented should not be viewed as indicative of the advisor's skill and do not reflect the performance results that were achieved by any particular client. During this period, the advisor was not providing advice using this model, and clients' results may have been materially different. Hypothetical model results have many inherent limitations, some of which, but not all, are described herein. One of the limitations of hypothetical performance results is that they are generally prepared with the benefit of hindsight. In addition, hypothetical trading does not involve financial risk, and no hypothetical trading record can completely account for the impact of financial risk in actual trading.